Good evening. My name is Abby Welsford, and I am a student project supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Latin American Studies, American Studies, and Sociology departments, I would like to welcome you to this evening's program, The Virgin of Guadalupe on the Road to Aztlan. Over the centuries, the Virgin of Guadalupe has become an important icon in the representation of Mexicans and Mexican Americans. The Virgin of Guadalupe is believed to be an apparition of the Virgin Mary and has become one of the most revered symbols in many Catholic churches across the United States and in Mexico. Many Chicanos, or Mexican Americans, have gained strength in the face of adversity from the Virgin of Guadalupe. Although more than 20 million Chicanos live in the United States, they still face discrimination every day. The Chicano movement struggles for better education and equal opportunities. Chicano women have also been instrumental in the movement. Yolanda Lopez is a political artist who portrays herself and other female family members as the Virgin of Guadalupe in her work. In her series, Portrait of the Artist as the Virgin of Guadalupe, Lopez portrays both older and younger women as the Virgin. Some of her images have women in running shoes, demonstrating the importance of female liberation and mobility in the United States. Lopez received her bachelor's degree in painting and drawing from San Diego State University in 1975 and received her Master of Fine Arts degree in visual arts from the University of California, San Diego in 1978. She has had exhibitions of her work, Cactus Hearts, Barbed Wire Dreams, Media Myths, and Mexicans, appear in several locations in California. Lopez has lectured at the University of California, Berkeley, and San Diego, and also teaches studio art classes. At this time, I would like to ask you that you disable all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Yolanda Lopez.
You've been looking at this picture? Good. What I do as an artist, actually, I didn't figure it out till almost 15 years after I started doing art. What interests me is how we know what we know when we look at a picture. And so I'm interested in looking at not only the content of a picture, but also its social, political context. In other words, where and how it exists. So what is this picture about? I mean, yes, we know it's about aliens and it's undocumented aliens, and it's really an ad for machines here, these printing machines. But what is it really about? I mean, I heard Bill Riley talking about this. I heard other people talking about this. Can we sort of agree it's about Mexicans? Yeah? Yes? You got to say yes or something. I don't know if you're awake or... yes? Does it make sense to you? Yes? Okay, thank you. So so it's like what you would call a visual pun, right? So it's... And it's also one of the reasons why I'm interested in images and how they function is because they not only affect how we see ourselves, but it also affects how other people see us. But I think to me, one of the most important elements is how it creates consensus. And that to me is probably more important politically, although it has aspects of how socially and whatnot, and how we know things, but we don't quite know why. And that to me is like consensus. It's the unspoken content that transfers to us when we're looking at pictures, especially pictures over and over and over again. Okay, so we know that the resident alien, it's the green card, actually, but it's pink, but the green cards are pink. Okay, and all these, but you got the message, right? Good. Next, please. And I'm going to show you now, I'm going to show you family pictures, and then I'm going to show you how I, as an artist, work, my thinking. I'm going to allow you to look at my thinking, because I think one of the things that happens is a lot of times artists, we don't show the process. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that. Okay, this is my great-grandmother. Next. This is my great-grandmother's family, which is my grandmother's, my maternal grandmother's family. So that was her, my grandma's mother, and I think that's where she is. This is actually a very comfortable Indian family. My family, my mother's grandmother's family comes from Mexico, DF, the capital, and they lived in a place called Santa Anita, which was like Xochimilco. There was a lot of, they were flower vendors. They would, you know, walk their flowers into the Zocalo, the center of Mexico City, and sell them. So they're, some of them have shoes, some of them don't. They're dressed very in sort of a colonial fashion. Very, very dark, very, very Indian looking. Okay, next. Oops, there we go. This is my grandfather's family. Again, it's about the same time as my grandmother's family, which was about turn of the century. And here is these are obviously more upper middle class families. They're probably considered upper middle class for the times. They're very dressed very elegantly. This is a wedding party. So obviously, I don't know if it's obvious to you, but here's the groom, you know, enjoying his wedding. And what's interesting to me is I think this might be his mother and this might be his great-grandma. And my grandpa is the guy with the mustache holding the baby. Where is the bride? Where is the bride? Yeah, that's right. This is the bride. She's the only one that's looking away from the picture. I mean, this is how we begin to like, oh, what does that mean? Okay, next. My grandmother and grandfather came to the United States after they had lost five children. And this is primarily because of the dysentery. It was dysentery and influenza because of that big influenza thing that swept not only the United States but also Mexico, killing a lot of young people for the most part and older people. So this is what they looked like when they were married. This is their wedding picture. They came in 1918. Next. This is my grandmother. They went through Texas, through Brownsville, Texas, and they caught a train and they went into Louisiana. And my mother was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. And that's my mother there and my grandma. But my grandmother just did not like the heat and the humidity. It was just torturous for her. You have to remember she grew up in a big city that's very cool and very moderate temperature. I want you to again, my grandfather, by the way, was a tailor. He had many skills, but he sort of decided that when he moved to the United States that he would become a tailor. I mean, that would be his primary occupation. So you can see, you remember how you saw my grandma before and her family. So this is, a step up in class. Okay, she's got this very elegant attire and her little pointy shoes, and she had bunions all her life. And I always wondered why that was until I, you know, as an adult, I saw these pictures. Okay, next. So this is Central Park, by the way. This is my mother, who's about maybe 5 or maybe even 6 years old, in Atlantic City. That's my grandpa. And you can see he's a very snappy dresser, especially like since he was a tailor, so he was very conscious about well-made clothes and looking very good. So, and that's, he's holding my Uncle Henry in Atlantic City. And some of my uncles were born in New Jersey, and Atlantic City was one of them, one of the places. They lived in New York City. My grandfather found a job as he made women's suits in a department store. So, he could support his family. Obviously, he was, you know, an educated man and very, very interesting on other aspects. Okay, next. This is my mother. One of the things that happened was when they were in New York, and I'm not sure why, but my grandfather decided he wanted to go west. And so he bought a Packard, a big car, and put his wife, my grandma, and my mother, and I think they had two or three children at the time. And my grandmother says they left diapers all the way across the U.S. They tried Texas. They did not like Texas. And they ended up in San Diego, California. And my grandfather bought a little farm, and that's how they survived the Depression. They had, you know, some goats, and they had a, you know, truck garden. And my grandfather found a job in downtown San Diego, again, as a tailor. So my mother grew up there, but, you know, she was born in Shreveport, as I said. And this was about maybe when she was 20 or 21, before she gave birth to me. Next. Her name, I should tell you. My grandfather's name is Margarito Franco. But since Margarito was, his male often was addressed to Mrs., he changed his name to Zenobio, which was the name of his father. So I didn't know that that was his name till long afterwards when I was a little bit older. And my grandmother's name is Victoria. Victoria Fuentes Castillo. And she married my grandpa when she was 15 and he was like 25. So when they came across the U.S., they were a little older. They were like, I think my grandma was like 26 at that point. My mother's name is Margaret Franco. She married twice. My name is Lopez because that was her first husband, Mortimer Lopez, who a man I never knew because the marriage was very brief. And she married a second time when I was about 12 years old. And his name was James Madison Stewart from Oklahoma. Yeah, true American, right? So this is us in San Diego. So it's myself in the center, my sister Mary, my sister Sylvia, and my two cousins, Ruthie and Henry. And next. And my Uncle Mike. I'll show you my Uncle Mike because he was my mother's favorite brother. And he was the youngest of my uncles. And he was like 12 years old when I was born. And so he took care of me a lot when I was younger. And he ended up being the reason why I went to college. If he hadn't helped me out, I don't think I would have gone to college. I went to high school, went to public high school. And 4 days after I graduated, he came with his friend in a big Cadillac convertible, baby blue with the top down. And I brought out my two shopping bags of the clothes and things that I owned, put them in the back, and we drove up to San Francisco. Mike and I had talked about moving to San Francisco because it was sort of like the end of the beatnik generation, and there was still that, and also there was sort of a gay scene going on in San Francisco, which excited my uncle as well. He had already gone up 2 or 3 months before he came to get me, and he worked as a hairdresser. Here, this man, my uncle was a brilliant, creative genius. He had gotten a scholarship right before he had graduated from high school to an art school. And he found out that he suspected that the teacher, his art teacher, would pay for the tuition. And he was so embarrassed that he quit high school, so he'd never graduated from high school, and joined the Navy. So that, you know, obviously to me I think it was just tragic and how his life might have changed a lot. But anyhow, he worked hard as a hairdresser. And when my grandfather died when I was about 11, he became, I don't want to say my father, but he became my guardian, as it were. So that's why we went to San Francisco together. He didn't know how to get into college, but he would be there to support me, and I had to figure it out. Okay, next. This is my Uncle Bobby. And I wanted to show you Bobby and his wife, what we call Big Margie, and then there's Little Margie. And then here's my grandmother, who is, again, standing in, and Big Margie's mother. Now, I show this because I often say, well, who's the Mexican here? And and it's sort of a tricky question in a way because of how we view Mexicans. The Mexican citizens are these two ladies. They were Big Margie was born in Tijuana, and she had dishwater blonde hair, hazel eyes, and she met my handsome uncle Bob. He was one of the people born in Atlantic City, and this is their daughter, my cousin, little Margie. So I show you that because Mexicans, we're not a race. We are a culture. Because you have to remember that when the Spanish came to Mexico, what became Mexico is called Tenochtitlan, the Europeans were about 50,000 eventually in the first 10 to 15 years. But since the indigenous people died off very quickly. Some people say they willed themselves to death. Some say they were worked to death. Some say that the smallpox and killed them all. They had no immunity to the diseases that followed the Europeans. But the Spanish imported 50,000 Africans. So that when you think about what Mexicans are. Oh, and there was also Chinese that came over on the Pacific side because they were craftsmen during the era. And so when you see a lot of like the blue and white ceramic stuff, that a lot of that is came over from China, not to mention the Spanish and the Moors who brought also part of that culture to Mexico. So you have to understand, as I said, that we are not a race, but we are a culture. So Mexicans can be any color. Okay, next. And when I moved to San Francisco, I graduated in 1961. By 1963, there had already been a movement from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which some of you probably already know. And so I joined that group on campus. And we literally sent some of our students to join in the bus rides to white students who went south to help American blacks, which were called Negroes, by the way, there, Negroes. So now, and then blacks eventually said, we're black, or we're African American, so that there was a self-naming process that went there. And so that was the first time that I sort of became aware of the civil rights movement. And I really saw it as black and white, which I think still to a certain degree exists out there, but it's I'll tell you, it's incorrect. But so that, so 1963, I joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but it was also, my mother worked in the union. She was not a union organizer, but she worked as a secretary in the union, and because she worked as a laundry worker at that point, and worked in hotels and whatnot. And this is an aside, she taught me never to cross a picket line. So even to this day, you could bludgeon me on the other side, but I would never cross a picket line, a union picket line. So I was also I went to work at a movie theater in San Francisco. And by then I was living in a small hotel, just a one-room hotel, and going to work at the movie theater at night and going to school during the daytime. And there was a big strike in 1968 for ethnic studies at the school. And this is like one of the first universities that actually had a strike where students actually wanted ethnic studies. So that meant studies for Latinos, women's studies, Asian studies, Native American studies, and of course we were all led, the leadership that developed us was really the BSU, the Black Student Union. And the faculty, the AFT, also joined us, and eventually after a year of struggle, we did have established the rudiments of an ethnic studies program, which is still there. And having gone through that, I became aware that the civil rights struggle was not just black and white, that there was a history of Asians, there was a history that we knew nothing about, there was a history of women that was coming into consciousness at that time, because the second wave of feminism was about 1972, although it started before then. Native Americans also, because there was all that activity at Alcatraz and AIM, American Indian Movement, was very active. So there was a lot of stuff going around, and I began to look at myself, especially with other Latinos, about my life as a Mexican American. And since I was in the art, and by the way, the art department was the first department to go out and join the strike, and they also made posters for us. So I started as an artist. I wanted to look at, this was made in 1974 at a Estrada Courts, which is a public housing unit, so that the idea came up not only of us working for our civil rights, but wanting to learn our history, but also there was the idea of public art, the idea of public art to bring up issues that were not brought up later. And I had somebody argue with me about public art, you're didactic, it's propaganda. And I said, well, what about the windows of Chartres? You know, that again was the windows there were made to talk about Christianity and to educate the illiterate population about how it worked. So I looked at this and I said, geez, okay, here we have the Aztec Indian, the Spaniard, and the Mexican Revolutionary, and then four young men current for the time. And I said to myself, well, how do these guys propagate? How do they reproduce themselves? Because there was no women, right? So women were not part of this compendium of heroes. Next. So this one, it's the same sort of pantheon, you know, the Aztec Indian, the Spaniard, the revolutionary and the contemporary man. And what they're doing is they're planting in the flag, which was for the United Farm Workers, which Cesar Chavez headed up and fought for unionizing farm workers. And not only that, but also to protect them from pesticides that were dropped on them as they worked. Not even, it's very interesting, it's not even thinking about the workers in the field as workers or as human beings, they would never do that to their own families, but here they sprayed. And here is a woman, so here's a woman, she's on her knees, and she's faced away from this era, this development. And there's a little boy next to her, and she's grinding corn. And since women are always associated with nature, those of you who study women's studies know that, and so she's facing this stand of corn, okay? And I said, you know, this is like where what sort of kicked me off as, you know, like as an artist, you know, there needs to be, since I felt part of the Chicano movement, which was Chicanos are Mexican-Americans, who are what I call politicized, who most of us call politicized. So not all Mexican-Americans are Chicanos. So if you use that, you best not use that word unless that person calls themselves a Chicano, okay? So it's a politicized Mexican-American, and that's what I was. And I said, well, if we already are beginning to draw our heroes and whatnot, where are the women? You know, we need imagery for women. Next. Oh, and then there was some images of women. There were something like 12 newspapers out of the colleges from in the Southwest that were circulating around by students. And this was one of the images that came up. And I understand the intent here. So this was about 1974 or something like that. There is a date on it. I can't remember what it is. But it's around that time. And I looked at it and I said, I understood the intent. And I think you understand the intent as well, right? So we wanted some things heroic and whatnot. But I looked at her, and she's holding a gun, a rifle in particular. She has this wonderful, sweet face. And her hair is pulled down and pushed to the front. And she's wearing a brown beret, which was another group. The brown berets were another group that were forming along with other groups, civil rights groups, in the Chicano movement. I said, but can this woman actually shoot that gun? I mean, is this really, do you think she could shoot it? Highly problematic, is it not? And then I said, well, who made this? Was it a man or was it a woman? It was a man, thank you. I think it was a man. And I've been told that there was a man who did a lot of the photo shoots at the time. And I can't remember his name, but that's recent knowledge on my part. But I said, this is probably a man, because it's a pinup, is it not? And I said, well, what do I mean? Yeah, we don't need this, really, you know. But I understood the intent, but, you know, we needed to make other images of ourselves. Next, and I say us as women. Oh, is that it? Okay. Oh, so I started doing drawings and paintings. This is a drawing collage of my grandma. Next, and this is when my grandmother was middle-aged and my grandfather had recently died. So I made a picture, drew a picture of her, and used a Scientific American upside down as part of her cuffs and collar because I wanted to sort of contain her. And in her dress, I put folkloric dancers. So I wanted to sort of contain her passion. My grandmother was an Indian. She had very much like an Indian sense of humor, very dry and very filled with irony. Okay, next. And this is like what she looked like when I actually did the drawings. And I put them up. I was invited with another group to in a gallery in Logan Heights in San Diego, California, which is the Mexican part of town. And I took my grandmother there to go see it. And so she looked at it, you know, and then when she came to this, she told me in Spanish, "Ay, Yolanda." I said, "What's wrong, Grandma?" And she says, "Oh, all those wrinkles on the neck." You know, she was 89 years old, and she's saying I put too many wrinkles on her neck. Okay, next. But she's always been a good spirit. So I also started, I had lived in San Francisco and I had moved to San Diego. And I began to see my family very different. So I saw my mother, that's my mother, and my grandma as mother and daughter. Which is very different than saying my grandma, my mother. It's I saw a relationship of mother and daughter. And I began to at least to get some perception about how my mother struggled with her mother growing up. My mother was the first child to survive, the oldest, and she had four brothers coming in after her. So you can imagine. Okay, next. So I used this image of to sort of like, I used it several times. And this is a pen and ink drawing of my mother and my grandmother. And sort of beginning, trying to figure out how am I going to work with them? Because I wanted to work with something less idealized than what we had in the past and what we were working with. I wanted something more that we were, you know, Chicanos and Mexicanos, we're primarily a working class population here in the U.S., and I wanted to somehow reflect that. So I began to use my family as sort of models. Okay, next. Back one more. Okay, thank you. Very sensitive thing, huh? This is, I took a photograph of my mother, and this is in my grandmother's yard, and this was mid-70s, maybe 76, something like that. And I had decided to do, at that time in the mid-70s, there was a great deal of interest in body language. There was a book that came out, I think Göttingen, I can't remember his name, did a book on body language so that how you, if you're doing like this, you're very, wanted to keep everything sort of contained or sitting like this. You know, it was just, you know, how your body and how you sat down expresses you. It's another way of knowing somebody else. There was also, this was, like I said, the rise of the second wave of feminism. We were all looking at also at ads and looking at media and how women were portrayed. And, you know, the lack of variety of women and that there was almost no real imagery of women of color, very, 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 very few. And so I decided to do three images of my grandmother, my mother, and myself, seeing us as part of a generational difference, each of us having our own body language, each of us, constructing ourselves and how we are seen. Next. So I did a drawing. So this is 4 feet by 8 feet tall, and it's basically charcoal and Conte drawing. And I wanted to do that because I wanted to make it big, because when we look at drawings and we look at small pictures, the viewer, because we were talking also about the gaze, right? So that the viewer controls the how long you're working and what you're looking at. Let me look at the time. Okay, not much time. I wanted to, if I made big pictures and the viewer is looking, especially a woman of color, you know, it sort of creates a different dynamic, you know. Next. Okay, that's fine. My grandma, and I lost a picture of myself, but there you can see again, just sort of an older woman, which you never saw older women at all, white or black or brown or anything. Okay, next. So going back to San Diego, in San Diego, I also saw the border differently, and I was not the only one. And this was the Carter administration had a lot of pressure on it. When did the Vietnam War end? I know somebody knows. 75. Good. Oh, I know where he found out. Very good. You remembered. That number will stick in your brain. That's excellent. So that one of the things that happens when there's war is that technology, the development of technology, accelerates. So that the idea of looking infrared lighting to look in the dark, heat sensors looking at so you could identify heat, people at night. There were motion detectors that were plotted along so that if somebody passed an area, you could actually know where they were going. And it was the first time that helicopters were used as assault weapons. Because before, they were used primarily as supplies and, you know, taking people, wounded and whatnot away from the field of battle. So, but all that technology ended up where? On the border, you know. Carter next allocated some money. And this is a sketch, okay? Next, please. And this is also a sketch. Because the word Vietnamization of the border started coming up, and because I was working with a group called the Committee on Chicano Rights, trying to figure out, because we had no visuals. I said, we got to have visuals. Okay, next. Back. There we go. It's hard to see, but I had, because it was also the bicentennial, 1976, right? So that, you know, that was all in our heads about the development of our country and all that. So I you can't see it, but it was like, I had the Mayflower going here and the tank going there so that, going into Vietnam and the barbed wire and all that. So again, thinking about it, because I grew up like the rest of you, you know, our forefathers and foremothers came across on the Mayflower and, you know, that's mine too, you know. I mean, I accept it obviously symbolically, and all of you accept it symbolically. But it's the origin of our nation, and I think all of us accept it. Next. So I ended up doing a drawing. This is the final piece. And so what I did was sort of an Aztec warrior crumpling up immigration plans. And I say, well, who's the illegal alien? Pilgrim. And it's very interesting because it's very cultural specific. I had a friend who was Australian, and she said, Yolanda, I mean, why, you know, what's, she's thinking of pilgrims as religious, you know, people going, and because she didn't understand it, how we understand it here in the origins of our country. Next. We're going to go real quick here. Okay, next, the Virgin of Guadalupe. The Virgin of Guadalupe, very important. She's the Virgin Mary, the mother of Jesus Christ, and she's the Mexican version of the Virgin, and she was said to talk to this Indian in his Nahuatl language, and she was dark-skinned, and she said, you know, build me a church here. This was in Mexico City, Tepeyac, and he tried to get in and couldn't get in because talking to the bishop, because he was just a lowly Indian. So she said, I'm going to give you these fine Castilian roses. You present it to the bishop, and he'll know that I talked to you. Okay, so he does, and when he loosens his tilma, his cloak, her image appears. And that's the image that exists to this day in La Villa, in Mexico, central Mexico City, and where there's a lot of pilgrimages to that. Next. Okay, how am I doing on time, kiddo? 5 minutes. Okay, so this is a detail of what the original looks like, very young. Okay, next. And this is the bottom. And I want you just to notice that here's this little angel. And a lot of Chicanos say, well, it's the baby angel or Mexican. But it's really like a middle-aged man with the receding hairline, looking very, very Spanish. And what is he doing? He has one hand on her cloak and one hand on her dress, okay? And there's all this yardage, I mean, at her feet, you know. I said, can this woman walk? Next. So I decided just to trim her dress and put her some shoes and just give her a little bit of, I didn't know what to do, mobility, because what I was trying to do was to make another image for us. Next. And so I had this transparency, and I went around looking to see other love goddesses. So this is obviously Venus rising from the foam, Botticelli. A very beautiful one, but next it was a Venus. It was a god, a lot of goddess of love, but not the kind that the Virgin of Guadalupe was. The Virgin of Guadalupe is essentially a mother. So I said, well, she's never portrayed as a mother. She's never presented with baby Jesus. So and she's supposed to be half indigenous Indian woman. And so I said, here's a Mayan, because we're all mestizos to us. Great degree, and this is what I showed. And I found out that one of my friends could not bear to look at this, and she was, I thank her, because I said, well, why not, Mariana? She says, well, she's too dark. I said, And she says, and the baby's too big. And you have to remember that this was in the mid-70s, which was also the rise of feminism and a lot of activity, and even in the, you know, bringing home the bacon and wearing pantsuits and all that, there was a lot of stuff going on. But it was also the rise of Penthouse and Hustler magazine, and this is like where, if you haven't seen Penthouse or Hustler magazine, it just sort of escalated the idea of mainstreaming pornography. It's what we call soft pornography. So all of a sudden, these magazines became available in grocery stores and everyday life. Next. We're going to have to go this real fast. Okay. So again, next. I started working with it, and again, working with these ideas. Next. And that's my mom. I started end up gluing my mom's head on the Virgin of Guadalupe. I said, oh, this is interesting. Next. Next, please. And I went to my mother's job, and I photographed her there at work because I wanted to show a working woman. I thought that was one of the images. So what I was shooting was I was working for three generations, three different sizes and three different ages of women. And so I said, we've already done the generations. I said, we'll just do that to the Virgin of Guadalupe next. So I wanted to show my mom working. And I strongly urge all of you, photograph your mother working. I don't care what she does. If she sells real estate, if she sells Avon, or, is a housewife, just show her at the grocery store picking out the best vegetables and fruit for you. Next. So I did my mom as the Virgin of Guadalupe sitting at her sewing machine. And so this is, we don't have to wait for, the idea was that we don't have to wait for the honor to be bestowed on us. We can do it ourselves. Next. And I did a portrait of myself. Oh, this is my grandma. So I didn't want a sentimentalized image of my grandma as an Indian, so I showed her with a skin snake and a knife. This is where she has finished the skin. It's sort of symbolic of her life. It's ended, but she's in control of it. Okay, next. And I did a picture of myself. I was a runner at the time, and this is the first one I did because I'm not a believer, but if I was wrong, I felt that it should strike me dead first before it hit my mother or my grandmother. Okay, so next. Oh, and by the way, people always tell me, like, why is the Virgin stepping on the baby? And she's jumping off this pedestal, which is the moon, right? And actually, what I was trying to do is have her sort of jumping over him. But I said, you remember what he was doing, right? got in the way, you know? Next. So I started playing around with other images. Another time, another place, I will talk about that. Next. And this is the Coatlicue, the ancient Aztec goddess, and she has a lot of overlapping of symbols with the sun, the moon, the stars, and being the mother of the main god, which is Huitzilopochtli. It's like the Virgin Mary is the mother of Jesus. But we'll talk about that another time. Next. Okay, did a painting? Well, next. I want to be a good girl and come in on time. So when I had my son in 1980, I had already started collecting images of Mexicans, but not knowing what to do with it. I was thinking about paper plates, neckties, napkin holders, oh, a bunch of stuff. So when I had my son, I could no longer paint or draw because it was too labor intensive. So I just brought out my camera and I started photographing ads with Mexicans, and I photographed all the knickknacks that I bought. And it ended up being an exhibit, called a solo show called Cactus Hearts, Barbed Wire Dreams. And I commissioned a young man to design me a billboard and to advertise the show. Next. So this is the window that, this is actually, I had a little kitchenette with all those little kitchen little tchotchkes and all that. And I did a video, which I sort of made a place where people would sit down. I also set the table, and I did a little diorama here, which is hard to see, but it's like little, I have a son, so I like toy trucks. So it's one truck going this way, another truck going that way, sort of like on the border. And I put these little salt shakers made in Japan with sleeping Mexicans on the back. So they're going both directions. Okay, the gallery, Galleria de la Raza, said, oh, Yolanda, we got to put up, because people are complaining in the neighborhood, because I just had Cactus Arts, Barbed Wire Dreams, and they have to say that it's, you know, we're critiquing it. So they put down racist caricatures of Mexico because they were afraid they were going to get their window busted again. Okay, next. Okay, so this is the mythical, nostalgic, good Mexican, romantic. You've all seen this before. Okay, next. And this is especially characterized. I know some of you are not familiar with this image, but the little sleeping Mexican was a pervasive image here in the U.S. Its origin was in Mexico, but Mexicans also had many other images. But when this image transferred over, it just was everywhere. And, you know, it symbolized somebody who's lazy, has no ambition. Sometimes he's shown with a big liquor bottle. It's siesta time, you know, don't worry, whatever. It's sort of like the lazy, passive Mexican. So what I did was, and the ridiculousness of somebody leaning against a cactus to take a nap was, so I put this little dark Art Deco chair with little spines on the cushioned seat. But also for me, it became sort of a metaphor for the pain of racism. Next. And also within that exhibit, I had the contemporary Mexican, which was primarily seen as gangsters and girl gangs and illegal aliens and all that stuff that was going on about that time. And I, you know, this is next. So that's the contemporary Mexican. And looking at ads, you know, this one was very interesting to me because it's a good thing you're not my students, because I always have to make how does that woman? It's a very artificial position. And so the woman with the folkloric dress is obviously standing on a little elevated box or something. And they're both, you know, dressed blue and white, but who has the ethnic costume on? And it's, you know, this white woman, non-Mexican, with the red hair, beautiful. Like, who's the beautiful woman? And so we know. Okay, but it's also, I talk about it in the video that I made where it's, you know, it's also like a part of an appropriation of a dress, but of a culture, but it's also what I call American cultural imperialism. Okay? And that's part, we'll talk about tourist arts one of these days. Okay, next. Okay, so me, so I'm there, I have my son going down buying cereal, of course, and this stopped me. And it's supposed to be Faces of America. It's supposed to be contemporary. So here's a woman with her hair pulled back, hoop earrings. The hoop earrings are always a big giveaway, right? And this little folkloric dress, a little earthenware spoon, and a little wooden-handled bowl. And anyhow, you know what I mean. And I said, you know, here I am in Safeway, in the middle of the mission, and which are all where the Latino area. And I looked around. None, me or anybody else, looked like this. And I felt that it was a creation of a new Aunt Jemima that we all recognize. Next. Okay, so I ended up coming up with... an installation called Things I Never Told My Son About Being a Mexican. And I put barbed wire at the bottom. I painted barbed wire there, and I painted rickrack at the top. Next. So I'll just show you a few details that are on there. Ernie, you know, next. Next. This is Fisher-Price and a taco thing. But it's very interesting because actually it's like the little girl with the little blonde girl with the chef's hat. And I felt like it was trying to sort of de-Mexicanize the food, you know. Very interesting. And, of course, this is Taco Bell giving you instruction on how to eat a taco. Next. And this, again, was, you know, a T-shirt. It cost me $30 in early 90s, you know. And it was a heap of money, but, you know, for art's sake. But I looked at it, it said, Mex girl, young and exotic. And at the same time, very same time, there was this spread not only in San Francisco papers, but in Los Angeles about girl gangs. And this is primarily because there was a movie called Mi Vida Loca, which came out, which sort of spurred, it became highly interesting that there were gangsters who were women and who looked like pachucas, who were, you know, stacked hair, tight skirts, you know, all this other stuff. And hoop earrings. Okay, next. So, but there was, this is again more dioramas. Next. I did this all the way around the room for another. Oh, Ralph Lauren. Talk about classy. So Ralph Lauren created these wonderful sheets. They're replicas, true-to-life replicas of sarapes, which is a Mexican textile. Thank you so much. Mexican textile. And very much considered very much part of a rich cultural heritage. But he made sheets out of them. But the only problem was he made very pastel sheets, pastel colors. So, and looking at that, it suddenly dawned on me that who is he making these for? He's not making them for me. And I thought, well, shoot, because it was also like where the salsa thing and you know, it was over being, salsa was being eaten more than ketchup and there were salsa cook-offs and, you know, everybody, the recipes. And, oh, you know, all that stuff that happened and, you know, Howling Coyotes and there was a lot of housewares fashion that happened, the Southwest look. And I said, well, they like our culture. They love our food. But they just don't like us. Next. Okay, and this is, we'll just go through this. I did a piece on a nanny, the silent. You know, this is about beauty. I was invited to do something about beauty. And this is sort of like the silent woman that's in the house taking care of family and children. This is Zoe. You remember Zoe Baird, who was nominated by Clinton to be Attorney General? And then she was found out not to she found out that she had a couple that were not legal and that she was not paying Social Security or retirement. And I said, well, what's going on here? Here we are well into the feminist movement, and here's this high-ranking woman and everybody, because she's excited about her being Attorney General. And her husband teaches law at Yale, and she's not paying the little amount of taxes so that this woman could collect unemployment, so this woman could have some sort of retirement. It boggled my mind. I wondered what the Fellowship of Women was about. Next, we're going to do this quick, though. We're going to do this quick, okay? So I'll give you details on this. Next. Okay, and this is the detail of it. You know, again, there's a who is the beautiful woman? And here's the Latina there. She's got this basket where she's selling watermelon, and the model's there. And she's got the hoop earrings, but she's low off the shoulder. So that that woman's poverty is to emphasize the beauty of the other woman. Next. Okay, this is, I did one on San Francisco and the wetlands and Native Californians. Next. I also did a series called Woman's Work is Never Done. This is Amy Beale. Amy Beale was just magnificent. She was a student, graduate student at Stanford, and was interested in South Africa, and went to South Africa and worked under a scholar there, a South African scholar who was South African, learned the Xhosa language, and this was like before Nelson Mandela was voted. So she was working with, among women to teach them how it was very important to vote and how democracy worked. And unfortunately, this is her roommate, we're going home, these young kids were out, young black kids and South African kids said, "Settler, settler," so they yanked her out of the car and stabbed her in the face and killed her. And it was just, I mean, you know, obviously a waste. But her parents, her mother and father, when they came to get her, they had a press conference, and they said, you know, obviously that they're, you know, were heartstruck because of the loss of their daughter. But they said, you know, Amy was here, and she would be very embarrassed by all the fuss that's being made about her death, considering all the men, women, and children who were killed in South Africa fighting for their freedom. So, and I said, oh, and it was, they said it much more poetically, but it was, you know, it just knocked me out. So I said, I'll do a poster for her. Woman's work is never done. Woman's work is sometimes very dangerous, you know. And I connected her in the past with the suffragette movement, so there's voting at the top. And so I wanted to sort of put a link there about all of us. I hope all you, everybody here who's qualified votes, okay? Because, you know, like, your vote is the law. Your vote is the law. So you must vote. Okay, that's you don't want to surrender that. So, and I also found that young white women, I mean, Amy Beale was 23. Young white women, there's nobody for young white women to look at. No stories, no circulation of stories. There's no Rosa Parks. There's no Dolores Huerta. There's no circulation of stories for young white women to look at. And this is my offering. Okay, next. This is farm worker women. Again, women's work is never done. Dolores Huerta, who's a union organizer, I felt did the intellectual work, and the farm worker women here who actually operate big industrial machines in the field. We don't even know that women actually operate huge industrial machines. Next. And this is Your Vote Has Power. When Proposition 187, which denied educational and medical services to illegal aliens. And what are we talking about? We're not talking about men. Men don't go get medical care. They'd much rather die than go and see a doctor. So what we're talking about women and children. Denying them, and also that the proposition also said that we as teachers would have to, we were obligated legally to turn them in, or if we suspected they were undocumented, and doctors and nurses were also obligated by law to also notify if they suspected somebody. Anyhow, so this is a Latina. She's Ecuadorian. She's fertile. You can see her baby, and she votes. So I thought that's what would scare Pete Wilson, our governor, the most. All right, next. And, okay, this is real quick. I did one on Nike, and this is Athena. Next, because Nike sits on the... Just do go through to the three. Nike sits on the hand of Athena, right? She's her... Nike's her lieutenant, right? And keep going. So this was my idea of also, like... Also that... In Roman culture, Nike becomes victoire, victory. and she carries the little laurel leaf. And Nike is also a missile that we designed, you know, Americans, but we discontinued it because it had a nuclear warhead. It was designed to carry a nuclear warhead, but its range was only 25 to 35 miles. So that's like from San Francisco to Berkeley. And I said, anyhow. So what I did was I have this woman, sort of like industrialization and globalization. She's sewing a Nike shoe. And then behind her, I wanted to have this roiling passion, this roiling fire within her. And I put Nike missiles where usually her spools of thread went. Next. Okay, then we're coming in for the finish. Okay, in San Diego, they have this wonderful procession from the different parishes in the back of pickup trucks for the Virgin of Guadalupe. And let's just go through this. Give them about 2 seconds for each one. And I photographed that, so you can get the idea of where I work. Next, just keep going. Okay. So that was me at the time. And that's my last... So this is what I'm doing now. I'm doing flowers, Mexican flowers. So we are ready for questions? Okay. And thank you very much otherwise. Okay. So do you know what to do? They know what to do. All right.
Hi.
Whew, it gets warm in here, huh? Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. This was wonderful. I have many questions, but I'm going to just ask two.
First, why don't you stand up when you do that? Stand
what?
Up so we know who's asking the question.
Okay. So first, I would like you to comment on the role of language. And when I mean language, it's just, you know, idioma, like Spanish and English in your work, and how maybe that played a role in how to, you know, portray your identity and the identity of the communities that you are actually portraying. And well, that would be the first one. And second, you talked a little about this, but how would you go to portray, if you were, you know, you portray yourself as a young activist in your community?
Well, I was young then at the time.
Okay, so how would you go about portraying the generation of young Mexican-Americans and Latinos in the United States right now, which is, you know, very different in terms of identity and aesthetics.
That's two questions. Okay.
Okay.
The way I address language is in the titles. So the Running Guadalupe, I call her Portrait of the Artist as the Virgin of Guadalupe, alluding really to James Joyce. The other one is when I put my mother's and grandmother's name, I use like my mother's legal name, which is Margaret F. Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T. And I really sort of had to think twice about that because, it's not Spanish enough, it's not Latino enough. But I'm very glad I did it because there's a lot of Latinos who have other names other than what we classically call Spanish. So that was, to me, a very important step, although it seems... And the other thing is, like, taking what I would call, like, and they don't like us... Because I put that up on the wall above the Ralph Lauren installation, was that I wanted to sort of think out loud, you know, because I really feel that artists, in many ways, we dream out loud. So you're hearing there are sort of passing thoughts and what that's all I do with language. Well, the other question was about what? Oh, what I'm doing right now, I'm working on little by little, is a fashion show. I want to show the Virgin of Guadalupe. I want to do a fashion show for the Virgin of Guadalupe, so that I wanted her to be coming in like different occupations. So, what would if the Virgin with her same sort of, you know, accoutrement? So it would be like the Virgin of Guadalupe working as a farm worker, the Virgin of Guadalupe working as a waitress, the Virgin of Guadalupe working as a bus driver, an 11-year-old Virgin of Guadalupe. A 15-year-old Guadalupe. So I've been looking at fashion magazines, which is a lot of fun because I haven't looked at that in years and years. So to see how people dress. And anyhow, so that's a night. And I'm going to end with a big wedding ensemble because that's how classic fashion shows end. And I want to have two women, my wonderful lesbian, Daiki, and lesbian friends going down as sort of a wedding. But it's, you know, that's something I wanted to end it with. And anyhow, so that's what I'm working on. That's one way of, like I say, of contemporizing the same idea, but making it as a fashion show. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Más o menos? Okay. Next, anybody else? No? I answered all your questions?
Hi, Yolanda. My question for you is, you had an opportunity to end on the slide, but you didn't have a chance to talk about it. And one of the things that I find interesting about it is that it clearly doesn't have the kind of political content that you usually give to your work.
You
and
are
so I thought
deadly.
Maybe you could talk about this in a political context, because I know you have.
Yeah. I walked into my 60s a few years ago, and all of a sudden I had this urge to paint flowers. And I had no idea why. I wanted to paint something beautiful. But I had no, I didn't want, you know, still lives and all that stuff. I just didn't know how to do it. And also because it had no, what I would call, political content. So I couldn't rationalize it to myself. So I was talking to my friends, beauty is revolutionary, trying to build up a little support group. But I think it can be. So what I did was I grew up on the border and, you know, left when I was 18. I mean, really, right there on the border. So if somebody were to ask me, like, what Mexican art I saw was familiar with, would have been tourist arts. That's the only art that I saw. So it was plaster pigs, it was bulls decked out in velvet, and it was velvet paintings, it was painted skirts, you know, all those little knickknacks and things that, if you don't know, but there's, you can imagine what they were. And one of the things that was there is also tooled leather bags, which were carved out with these flowers, and they were sold for tourists. You know, and but I have always loved them. You know, what can I say? And so I didn't know what motif to work, so I started using the some of the patterns on the tooled bags, the leather bags, the tourist bags. And what's very interesting to me is that when my friends started looking at this, they immediately saw that it was Mexican. It was very, very interesting. I don't know where I'm going. I'm just going to keep doing it and try not to think about it too much, and we'll see what happens. Does that answer your question, Carrie? Oh, you are bad.
No?
Talk about Iraq? Did I talk about it in this context? Oh, God, I don't even remember. What is it? I have all these conversations, and who remembers what I say? What are you, give me a clue.
Something beautiful in the midst of something.
Oh, okay. The other thing is, one of the things that sort of spurs me on is that it's, because all of us right now, we all live, you know, if Turkey invades northern Iraq with the Kurds, there's going to be what they call a cascading effect. It'll be like when the Kaiser was shot, and then all of a sudden things build up from that. So we're in a very, very scary time. And I follow the news. I love politics, I love art, but, you know, and I felt that maybe part of this was sort of my way of doing some mental health, you know, because right now we live in such fierce, and I'll tell you, frightening times that there's no looking away, to tell you the truth. You can't look away in Hollywood. You can't look away on TV or even radio. We all listen to NPR. So it's just no escaping it. So this is my way of saying we can celebrate our culture and beautiful flowers and give us all a little bit, and for me personally, a little mental health. Like I said, I don't know where it's going, but that's, is that what you were talking about, Carrie? Thank you, yeah. Anything else? Yes. Give her a mic. Oh, sure.
Thanks. Sure, all the murals in San Francisco, like in the Mission District, mm-hmm. It's really this incredibly rich tapestry. It's right. Wonderful to walk around down there and see all that. And I'm just wondering, as you create these,
What are some of the responses that you get from the community, both from kind of the gentry that come into these communities because they really appreciate the look and the feel, the culture that's apparent everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm looking for a spectrum. Like, what are some of the positive things and what are some of the...
Around the murals?
About your experience doing murals.
I don't do murals, unfortunately. I've worked with other, sort of as an assistant and as a consultant to young people doing
your
murals.
Your work in San Francisco.
Well, shoot. I did the Virgin of Guadalupe, that big one with the Coatlicue, which is the goddess there. And it was a group of, we were commissioned as artists to do work in the studio so people could come in and see it. And I was doing this Guadalupe, merging her with the Aztec goddess. And somebody threw a brick right through it. And then I had groups of Guadalupanos, which is a church group, coming to ask me, like, what are you doing? Because the conservative Catholics see it as a sacrilege. And I will tell you, I will fess up to you, it is a critique of the church. It is a critique of the church and how it portrays women. Because you have to remember, the Virgin Mary does not have power of her own. And the only power that she has is of referring you to her son or referring you to God. So, and I think also that men and women react very differently to the Virgin. And I think that men see her as the uncompromising mother who loves you totally, no matter how bad a boy you've been. Always loves you and always forgives you. Never turns away from you. Whereas women, I think, identify with her and her pain. The fact that she is a mother who saw her child die and the suffering that she endured. I mean, you can imagine the suffering that she endured. That I think that's what women identify with. So sometimes that comes in conflict. So that men are more likely to confront me rather than women in the Virgin of Guadalupe stuff. And then, you know, the little walking Guadalupe, the first one I did, you know, just with a little short skirt. It wasn't short. But that was shown in Mexico on a magazine cover called Femme, which is the equivalent of Ms. And there were... the Femme offices got bomb threats, and the kiosks that sold the magazine were trashed. So that's Mexico. I mean, is that what you're... Where is she? Is that what you're talking about? Who's the illegal alien is... Did I show that? I did, yeah. You can go on the internet and Google that, and you can see people are blasting me for being anti-American or, you know, I mean, it's, you know, take your pick. So there's a lot of people who love it and people who hate it. And that's sort of like, I don't do pretty stuff, you know, and that's sort of the nature of it. And it's, you know, it is what it is.
Wanda, I have...
You're going to stand up.
And I don't. Is it on? Okay.
Stand up.
Sound like
stand up.
Okay. Well, yes, well, I have a question about, you know, you've been involved in politics.
Yeah.
This is political art, and you've been involved in social movements.
Yep.
In the Chicano
right.
social movement. Since the 1960s, really.
Right.
For many years, that time when it was actually emerging
right.
at that time. And I just, I've been looking at, you know, we've all been looking at the way that some of the recent artwork has, I think you've continued to represent some of the issues
yeah,
about the
I do,
border.
Yeah.
But I just wonder, in relationship to also the kind of changes in work that have taken place. I mean, I didn't see a lot. Maybe you didn't show us all of, I'm sure you didn't show us everything you've done.
No, I can't.
What's happened with, for instance, the farm workers movement.
Yeah.
That you were also living during that.
I supported them. I wasn't involved deeply in supporting them, but I supported them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm trying to get it.
What is my activism now as an artist?
And
okay.
What do you think is going? And also, just to extend on that, where are, if you could, mean, where are these politics today in the city of San Francisco? If that you're talking about the Bay Area, where usually it has been the heart of a lot of this, since there have been so many Mexican Americans and Latinos living out in that.
Well, the biggest population in San Francisco, Latino, is our Salvadoranians. The second are Nicaraguenses, and the third are Mexicans. But a lot of the institutions are Mexican, or at least originated by Mexicans. But anyhow, I taught for about 18, 20 years, and I taught ethnic studies. I was sort of ghettoized in a way because the colleges and universities found me very useful because not many people, you know, some of you hadn't quite graduated yet, so since I had a degree, and so I taught ethnic studies. So what I did was I taught Chicano art as a methodology. And by that I mean that looking at your own family, who you are, and looking at yourself in the larger context of American history, looking at your family in the larger context of other families like you, and looking at your own heritage. I did a lot of programs and exercises, you know, like name me your, pick out one set of grandparents and tell me their names and your grandmother's maiden name and what occupations they had and where they were born. And I tell you, it sounds very simple. I often had several students who could not do that because their family had lost that record for some reason or other. And I've had people do that who all of a sudden they started, just tapped into this little space where all of a sudden they started hearing family stories. And that's very important. So I did a lot of things, but, you know, I had them. So it was very indirect, let's put it that way. Because the way that I teach is a Chicana, and it's sort of trying to do it sort of holistically. So it isn't just the environment, it isn't just the women, it's all of us together, and all of that subject matter holistically together. And I think that's where the farm workers were really important. And, you know, we talk now about pesticides and pure food and organic food. Cesar Chavez and the farm workers were talking about, you know, wash your lettuce and some of the pesticides does not come off, and you know, you have to be careful what you eat, and you know, we got to get laws that are safe for all us if we're going to eat all that junk. You know, I mean, that, so there's other stuff. I also do mentoring, so I have several young people that I mentor, men and women, and for the most part, they choose me. And where they're, I'm so that I'm available to them if they're attracted to whatever I'm doing. We sort of developed our own group of Latinos contra la guerra, which we did a big banner during the early days of the Iraq war. I mean, we do. There's a lot of stuff, you know. I mean, and a lot of it, I think, is like. I think it's really important. It's an important question because how do you do political activity? You know, and there's a lot of ways to do it. And right now, the most immediate one is you vote. Okay, democracy is participatory. If you don't act in it, you're out of the game. And don't complain to me that who you wanted to get voted in wasn't voted in. Okay, you get somebody, your brother, sister, friend, or whatever, mother, take them with you, and you vote, okay? You can influence them as much as you want. I don't care how you vote. But the thing is, that's one thing. You know, that's something I include. The other thing is, look around you. I mean, if you're interested in Africa or in what's going on in that, look at everything. Find out what you can. Find out who's working. Also, look at the movies. I mean, you're all, you know, here as students, you're critical thinkers. Are you critical thinkers? Yeah, you're critical thinkers. Use your critical thinking in everything that you see, and especially use your critical thinking in what interests you. And handle what's around you. None of us escapes politics. None of us escapes culture. So you start focusing on what you can do, whether it's buying organic or, you know better than I do, but there's a lot of stuff that you can do. And you recognize other people who are doing it, and you can work with them. So you can start out as solidarity as you can, and then you can join other people. The other thing is, I can't do it alone, so I need you. To participate in it. I cannot do it alone. So I need you to participate in it. I need you to exercise those brains you have, this wonderful education you're getting. Okay? You got your homework? Yes.
In your title, I was just wondering, there's the word Aslan.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, could you touch on that subject a little bit more? And did it influence your artwork?
Yeah. Well, the concept of Aslan came out in the civil rights movement. And because even like in the feminist movement, there was also the idea of separatism, you know, that women were going to sort of adopt a state and move in, and we don't have to deal with men, and we'll have a free, egalitarian community and state. But also, the concept of Aztlán is that somewhere in the middle of the Southwest, and we don't know where, is the center, is the origin of our people. And we don't know where it is, but it's also... in studies, archaeologists think and it's told in our stories that from Aztlán, the Mixteca went down and established Mexico, what is now called Mexico City. So that for me personally, Aztlán is that road that we all travel on, and it's. Actually, for us, and when I say on the road to Aztlán, I mean for us as Americans, is we're coming into America, because every road goes two ways, right? So, and I think that part, this is where, on the road to Aztlán is where we, as artists, singers, dancers, and culture workers, contribute. Bear our gifts to broader America. Just like Africans are the definition of what is America. That's what makes us unique. As ugly a history as we have with slavery, it is still, in the end, being American and distinction of ourselves is basically African. It is jazz, it is our language, it is the way we dress, it is the way we dance. And that's where, and I think somewhere along the line that Latin America will also contribute to that in a way. And where, as Americans, you know, we will again add another layer that makes us uniquely Americans. You know, but Aztlán is sort of like the birthplace, but it's here in the U.S. somewhere, you know. And we can all travel on the road to Aztlán. I think we're done. Are we done?
On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to thank Ms. Lopez for being here tonight and present her with a token of our appreciation. Right here.